So, John, I'm thinking that the odds are this is a problem that you've had for a while, and it's just being noticed now because the detector was just installed before this flight. You've probably done a number of flights, possibly the entire time you've had the plane, you've been flying it with this issue, and it hasn't caused a problem yet. You also can see the level. It's not terrible, and it's dropping. By doing an immediate turnaround, possibly declaring an emergency, landing opposite direction, is the rush that you're setting yourself up for potentially going to set yourself up for some errors?
No, I don't think so, because this is not the impossible turn where you're turning around at 700 feet off the departure end of the runway. You're at 4,000 feet. You're about 10 to 15 miles south of the airport at this point. So to turn around and get set up for that runway one approach, you know, you're still going to probably fly 20 to 30 miles that whole time around, as opposed to going out for the 1-9 approach, which is going to be like 40 miles or so. It's going to double the distance. So I don't see a tremendous sense of got to get on the ground because we're on fire kind of thing. It's more about we don't know what the situation is. There's a lot of uncertainty here, and that's the thing that's making me take the choice to turn around and go back. You know, this is not like Hollywood, you know, where everybody's coughing and gagging and there's fumes coming out of the panel and stuff. The CO is the silent killer. You just don't know. And you don't know if this is something that's been going on for a while or if it's brand new on this trip. So I'm going to take the cautious way out, get back on the ground, and figure it out on the ground.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it is the approach that you briefed.
Right,
to come
and,
back
loaded.
Onto.
Exactly.
And loaded, yeah.
You know, so, and it's not a crash, you know, kind of trying to turn around real quick, so.
Mm-hmm. Doug, you are going to take the approach that everybody else is using here.
Yeah, I'm going to ask to go back and do the RNAV into 1-9. I mean, I agree, I certainly will load an approach back in quite often in the opposite direction, and it's merely two button pushes to activate that approach. It's already mm-hmm. loaded, so all we really have to do is activate it. That's not the issue. But my concerns are, is this really that critical of an emergency that it causes or might cause a big delay for Albany, because it is a Class Charlie airport, and there are a lot of rivals in there. We've got Southwest going there. We've got United. We've got Cape Air. There's a lot of people going in there. Another option is actually Columbia County is almost closer than anything else, just continuing straight ahead, but I haven't loaded that. So to me, going back to 1-9, turn off the heat, maybe open up the vents and be a little chilly. I'm sure the pilot's going to be sweating. So it's only the wife and kids who are going to have to deal with that coldness. I just feel it's not a need to declare an emergency and upset the flow going into a Class Charlie airport for this situation.
And just to be clear, the pilot wants to go back to their home base, not yours.
Right.
Yeah. Because you can't get anything done there anyhow.
But well, there's a nice guy has an office here.
Yeah, yeah.
That sounds like a question back to John, then. How much does it disrupt things at a Class C airport like Albany?
Well, it certainly would disrupt things. And I would declare the emergency if necessary, because you're going to have a few minutes to reassess this, too, as you turn around, communicate to ATC. They're going to have to give you some vectors or something like that. And then you're looking at it, too. Is the level dropping? Is it increasing? You know, what's the urgency factor here and what's their reaction? So definitely we want to turn around and come back. Then it just becomes a choice between which of the two runways. I would still offer runway one straight in and let them deal with the situation.
So for you, it's an emergency and continuing is a non-starter.
Right.
Dave, on the other hand.
Yeah, I don't think it is an emergency, and I think that you're overly complicating the situation. This is the first time you're flying with this CO detector. Who knows if it's accurate or not? I'm going to open a vent, put on a jacket, and get in touch with my inner airmail pilot and continue on to the destination. We'll check it out on the ground. It doesn't seem like an emergency, and I would think that turning off the heat and opening the vent is going to solve the issue.
Does it make a difference that you're flying with someone here, you're flying with your spouse? They seem a little concerned about it. You're also picking up the in-laws and then continuing on.
Yeah, but I'm going to Dunder Mifflin in Scranton. Who would miss that, you know? The other issues, is the spouse concerned about it? I mean, she's pointed out that the alarm bell, but it's like, I don't mean to minimize the threat of CO2. I mean, it's obviously real. I'm not lighting up a cigarette here, you know. And also in wintertime flights, you know, I really dislike using the heater, because of the threat of CO. So it's like, you know, dress appropriately, be ready to not use the heater, be ready for the heater not to work. It just doesn't seem that with this being the first flight with the CO detector in the airplane, no major maintenance done on the airplane since the last flight. Probably nothing's changed with the airplane. I don't see any reason for an immediate return or an emergency.
Yeah, and the thing that gets people with carbon monoxide is that it's odorless, and you don't recognize it often until you're unconscious, and then you don't because you're unconscious. But that's not likely to happen here because you have the number in front of you. If it gets worse quickly, you're going to see that, right? It's not going to sneak up on you. And so you have some options as you go.
Right. And we're talking about the level of a smoky bar. We're not talking about over 200, you know, that's an immediate threat.
So I just want to stay with you for 1 second, Dave. If you get to Scranton, you do your tour of Dunder Mifflin, and now you're picking up the in-laws to go the rest of the way. You aren't able to figure out what's going on here. Do you take off and tell them, you know, you may hear some beeping. It's the carbon monoxide detector. That's okay. We're just going to keep the windows open and wear a warm coat, right?
Yeah, I'm not really thinking that far ahead. You know, I'm just anticipating that when I get to my destination, I'm going to give the exhaust system a thorough look.
Sure. Catherine, you were one with an asterisk. What's the asterisk?
So for me, it's important to return to Albany. I would have actually chosen option two, like Doug, except there are some cells to the north. Also, I've got the RNAV to one loaded, and the winds are light. So I think it's important to get on the ground. I don't think it's necessarily important to get on the ground within just a few minutes, but I would have chosen two were it not for the storms.
Let's talk about the storms, because the pilot in this case was concerned about freezing rain. Should they have been concerned about freezing rain? Dave, I see you shaking your head no.
No, I mean, if you're in above freezing conditions and you've got, I mean, the time to worry about super cooled water droplets is when the temperature that you're in is below freezing and it's warm above with rain falling into below freezing temperatures. This is different.
Right. Yeah, it was a bit of a red herring in the scenario setup that you can be concerned about the cells to the north, but not because of freezing rain. Tom, you also had one with an asterisk, right?
Yeah, it was kind of what Catherine was saying. We've already got runway one approach loaded, and we've briefed it, so that makes it easy. But I wouldn't declare an emergency. I don't think it's at that level of risk. The levels are not that high. I mean, it's interesting. We just installed, my partners and I just installed one of the more modern detectors in our airplane, and it took us quite a number of flights to kind of see what the patterns were. And then we thought we had it figured out, you know, that you'd have a rather low reading while you're sitting on the ramp doing run up and that sort of thing. Then quickly after takeoff, boom, it's zero the rest of the time. But then we had a few flights where all of a sudden on the ground, we were seeing relatively high numbers of, you know, something like even into 70 or something like that sitting on the ground for a few minutes. And we became concerned, but they went away quickly as soon as it took off. And we had a mechanic actually check out the entire exhaust system to make sure there were no issues there. Turns out there weren't. And since then, suddenly now we're back to most of the time on run-up areas, you know, in single digits. And then as soon as you take off, it goes to zero. So just demonstrates that you do need a few flights with these things, it seems like, to understand what the patterns are. They all seem to operate a little bit differently and detect at different levels and go off at different levels, that sort of thing. So it is good to build some experience. But in this case, you got family on board. The weather's kind of questionable anyhow. And you have abnormal readings that you're uncomfortable with. So I think everybody would feel better just going back and checking it out and having a look-see. So not declaring an emergency, but getting on the ground as quickly as possible. Runway one is the way to do that. If, you know, as John was alluding to, if maybe in the turn, you kind of the levels start to drop and it's like you don't want to disrupt the traffic, okay, maybe we change our mind, we go to 1-9. But it seems like you do want to get on the ground.
John.
Yeah, and I think exactly what you said. The key for me on this was that I don't have any experience with this setup. So this is my first time. I have no baseline, no experience. They say that if you suspect CO, it's too late. because it's already in your blood and the levels are starting to build. The judgment is getting impaired. Do you want to fly around for another 10, 15, 20 minutes accumulating CO in your blood? Because CO works by displacing oxygen molecules in the hemoglobin. It's a cumulative effect, which is why it's parts per million based over time. And just when you're going to need to make an instrument approach down to a 400-foot ceiling, your judgment is starting to get clouded. And I think the risk factor of that is sufficient to take the quick way out and get back on the ground.
Bruce.
One thing we haven't talked about is, you know, declaring an emergency doesn't mean you have to rush. It just means you're going to get extra options and help from ATC. So I would go ahead and declare the emergency just so I can then tell them, here's my plan. I want to go out and do this approach, but I need a little time to get set up, you know, whatever it takes. They then understand the situation, and then you can let them worry about all the other considerations like opposite direction traffic and so forth. But declaring an emergency just says, I need some extra consideration here, some help. And I kind of wonder, John, even if I don't declare, if I say something like, I've got an abnormal indication here, I'd like to return, is ATC basically, they're thinking emergency.
Yeah,
they're sort of declaring it for you anyway, right?
Yeah, there's declared emergencies, and then there's a functional emergency where they're going to stop departures. That's the first thing they're going to do, stop departures off 19 and start coordinating. And even if you didn't declare an emergency, there's a good chance there's going to be some fire trucks waiting for you out there anyhow.
Basically, they're going to treat it like an emergency, even if you
exactly.
haven't said the E word.
Right. And and just get all the help you can for this.
And then tell the controller, I need a little time to get organized. Because
exactly.
in this setup, the pilot sounds like he's already a little distracted now and a little, you know, needs a little time. It doesn't
yep.
mean I have to just chop the power and get right back on the ground.
Right.
So let's say that you had this crop up en route or something, same levels, but it shows up en route. What's the best way to handle this? You know, right now, one way to handle it is to get on the ground quickly, but suppose you have to fly with it for a while, because we typically don't have a checklist for, you know, a carbon monoxide warning, right? Do you use the smoke in the cockpit procedure? Do you open windows? Do you, use oxygen, right?
Well, I just participated last week in an NTSB webinar, which was on exactly this, and it was an outgrowth of their safety alerts. And one of the points that they made was that O2 oxygen, supplemental oxygen, doesn't help because the time factor is so long. Sometimes it takes up to 2 weeks to get rid of the CO in the blood. So donning an oxygen mask really doesn't help. Nor does a pulse oximeter, because that's just looking at the hemoglobin going through your fingertip, and the hemoglobin doesn't have any oxygen in it. So that's what's causing the respiration difficulties and everything. So those two tools really don't help. But to go back to your point about maybe treat it like the smoke in the cockpit kind of thing, where you want to ventilate the airplane at least the best you can.
We often talk about launching into IMC with new equipment, right? I mean, certainly if you have a brand new GPS or an autopilot or a PFD or something like that, you're not going to make your first flight with it in hard IMC. Now, this pilot is launching into hard IMC with new equipment. It's a CO detector. It's not something we usually think of as something you want a couple flights with, but what kind of philosophy do you all have on IMC with new equipment? Would this be a no-go for anybody just for that reason?
Not necessarily. It's something that you probably wouldn't even think of. And I think this pilot didn't even think of it. It didn't consider it new equipment. So I don't necessarily think that you would pre-plan not to go into IMC with something like this. What would be interesting would be to look at this from the other side. Suppose it was VMC. It was a beautiful, clear day. Would you feel the same sense of urgency to get back on the ground? Or would you putter around there at 4,000 and try to troubleshoot?
Well, for those of you that are going back up, how about you, Bruce? If it's VMC, do you continue a little bit?
Since I'm not familiar with this equipment and I'm really concerned about this, I'd probably say, let's just turn around and land and see what's going on. Have somebody look at the airplane, make sure there's not an obvious exhaust leak or whatever. Maybe do another little test flight to see what happens if I actually go up, you know, leave the family behind, just go up and see what's going on. Yeah, that's what I think I mm-hmm. would do.
Does it change if it's not your home base?
Depends on, yeah. I mean, I'd still want to land and look at things. It's nice that this is, that's another reason why I would return, is it is my home base and I've got options there if I am stuck, you know. It's I'm not stuck
anywhere but Columbia County.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the other thing, you know, looking at the weather and so forth on this route, continuing on this flight, you continue to run out of options the farther you go, or good options anyway. You've probably got emergency options, but it's less and less attractive the farther you go.
Catherine.
Yeah, I had a personal experience with a CO that I'll share. Years ago, I was flying in VMC in my Cherokee, and I looked over and saw the card that I had affixed to the instrument panel, and the little dot that should be orange was dark. And I turned around and landed, had my mechanic come out, and it turned out my exhaust system leaked like a sieve. So that little card saved my life. I had no idea that there was an issue in the cabin. And when I give practical exams, CO is one of the things that we need to discuss with candidates. And I find a lot of them say that they will smell it. They'll smell the exhaust, even though on a rote level, they understand that it's odorless and they can't smell it, but they think they'll be able to smell it. So I share my personal experience with them, hoping to make a point that they might not smell it. And one takeaway is if you are renting airplanes and you're constantly changing airplanes, then putting one of those little $10 cards on your kneeboard could save your life. Or spending, I think they're a little over $100 for just a personal electronic one, which I actually have on my bag because I'm always hopping into multiple airplanes as an examiner, and I never know whether they're going to have a CO detector or not. So it's serious stuff, and I think this attention to CO in this scenario is going to serve some pilots well.
Yeah, and that's something John pointed out, right, of the 33 accidents that were on record, and who knows how many there actually are that were attributed to carbon monoxide, all but one had no detector on board, and that one, it turns out, was a spot detector, which you have to actively look at. It's not going to alert you. Dave?
You know, I had just another anecdote is I had a card detector in the airplane, bought a new one to replace it because it was near the expiration date. Then just thought, how much CO does this need to trip? So I walked out to my car exhaust, you know, started the car, put the card in the exhaust trail of the car, and it never tripped. It was completely worthless. And I think the new digital ones are way better. But I just thought, wow, what a waste of time this card one was, because even when you immerse it in exhaust, it does nothing.
Well, do you drive an electric car?
I can't imagine how much CI I must have had, given that I had that little card.
And then, you know, another anecdote, there was a friend that had a, you know, she was complaining of headaches after long flights. And, we took a digital reading in her airplane, and it was high, and ended up getting an exhaust extension on that solved the problem. So, you know, there's a, you know, people have lots of practical experience with this.
Yeah, and those spot detectors, they don't last forever either. They expire. You need to change them. Bruce.
And just, you know, to John's point about the difficulty of clearing it, it's my understanding that if you are poisoned by carbon monoxide, they often will put you in an hyperbaric chamber to, you know, put you under 100% oxygen at high pressure, because that's the only way to really force the stuff out of your system in a reasonable time. It requires some pretty extensive treatment, in other words, to help you if you get seriously poisoned by CO.
So just one more thing to close on that too is read the manual. There's many, many different kinds of detectors and many different parameters that could be set, alarms and things like that. So read the manual and know what your detector is capable of and where the alarm should be set.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about in this situation what might have happened if you didn't have this detector, if you didn't happen to put it in the plane this day. Because the stories that you hear of carbon monoxide poisoning, the people that survive these accidents, they just are going about their business, and then they wake up in a field somewhere with no warning. you know, maybe you would fly around with this problem, assuming it's a problem, for many hours before it gets worse, and then suddenly it gets you, you know, and you would never know if you didn't have a detector installed. So I suppose that's the PSA of this scenario, really, is get a detector, know how to use it, know how to read it, and have a plan for if it alarms, what you'll do.